Hi, welcome to Interviews with the Masters, brought to you by TheOutdoorInsiders.com, your number one spot for inside information and quality gear. I want to thank all you guys out there for making this podcast such a success. I didn't really dream that it was going to get this big this fast. And if you could help me out by helping me keep it free and going on, your comments, reviews on iTunes help me keep my placement high and help me keep my sponsors. So if you can get on there and give us a review and give us, subscribe and show that that we're loving the podcast, I can keep it all free for you guys. Well, today I have with us on the phone a dynamic duo of brothers. And if you've hunted in Arizona enough, and if you're an Arizonian, you've probably heard these two guys' name. Love them, hate them, whatever. These guys have been killing stuff in here with stick and string for as long as they could probably carry a bow. It's Dan and Dave Acosta. How you guys doing?
Doing good, John. Thanks for having us on.
So a little, why don't you give me a little bit of background about yourselves, and I don't know, maybe so you're not talking over each other. Let's, start Dave, and then Dan, you fill in the rest.
Okay, John. Yeah, we were born in Midland, Texas, and our father had us introduced us to hunting at a really young age. I want to say it was as early as 5 years old. And then around the age of seven, we moved to Arizona, kind of been here ever since. I'm married now for going on 17 years, and I got a boy and girl twins.
Crazy. So if you guys don't know, Dan and Dave are twins. I guess it's true what they say about that. That's a genetic thing that passes on pretty easy. Most people who are twins have twins. So.
Yeah. Definitely in my case, for sure.
Yeah. If you guys, you're electrical contractors, right?
Yeah.
Like Dave said, we moved to Arizona, and, growing up as kids, our dad was an electrician, and, he wanted to see us be electricians. That was his goal. Mm-hmm. And, me and Dave thought, that was a career that we would like to take. So, after graduating high school in 1994, we went to work for the same electrical company my dad worked for. And I ended up working there for about 8 years and decided that, at that time I wanted to advance a little bit further. So I went out and got my contractor's license in 2001. Mm-hmm. And pretty much started with, no financial backing, kind of the hard knocks ways, and going out, knocking on doors, looking for work, and, kind of started like that, and, we've been in business now 16 years. We have 12 employees, which,
that's awesome.
Being self-employed, the big bonus for us, as far as hunting goes, because, we can get away more than most people, having our business, at the point now where, the guys pretty much run it itself when we do need to get away. So that makes it really nice for us.
Nice. Very, very similar to my situation.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar to my situation. Everything about it, actually, too. I graduated in 94 and worked for some other people. But anyway, I actually met, it's funny, I had a guy, an AC guy over the house, HVAC guy over the house the other day, and he saw my mounts and stuff. He goes,
do you know Dan and Dave Acosta? I said, I sure do. That's, his name is Pat Garrett. He's like, I grew up those, I worked with their dad and knew those boys forever. So,
that's funny. Small world.
Small world, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. I was like, yeah, I'm actually going to be doing a podcast with them next week. So, anyway. Well, so I don't know how much you listen to the podcast or not, but Interviews with the Masters basically is just the way it sounds. We go out, we get questions thrown at myself all the time about, you know, different types of hunting and different types of situations and so on and so forth, and I kind of collect them. And if they're not questions that I answer myself, I basically go out and find the guys that I feel are best suited to answer the question. And I don't know too many guys that kill more shit than you guys here in Arizona. So basically, a lot of these questions were geared towards Arizona hunting. So I kind of I put them aside for you, so to speak.
Cool.
My first question, and I'm trying to figure out. Let's see. Let's start with this. What would you say is the three most critical factors that contribute to your consistent success? Because you guys kill deer every year. And
well, you know, I think the biggest factor, you know, being successful year after year is, you know, knowing your equipment. You know, what I mean by that is, you know, shoot your bow year-round. You know, whether it's in the backyard, you know, we shoot a lot of 3D tournaments, you know, locally here in Arizona, which, you know, I feel is a huge advantage. You know, I think the biggest thing is just, you know, being confident in your equipment, being confident in the shot. You know, most guys I know that are successful year after year, you know, tend to be really good shots. You know, they practice a lot. They're very confident. And, you know, I would say for me, that's the biggest thing, I think, of being successful is just practice, and you just can't practice enough.
I agree. I think that
another thing
confidence
is
huge.
You know, and not, you know, also practice, you know, in hunting situations, you know, even if you're in the backyard, grab a chair, you know, shoot from, you know, sitting in a chair, kneeling down, shooting, you know, just any situation you think you might encounter in the field, you know, because, you know, for me, shooting standing up, you know, our everyday routine is way different than, you know, shooting, sitting down or kneeling, especially kneeling for me is just a whole different ball game.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Then I would say oh, go ahead, Dave.
I would say, you know, the top three things I think that are the most important, you know, obviously I like to look at it as the three P's, patience, persistence, and preparation. Dan kind of touched base a little bit, preparation, you know, you got to know your equipment, got to be confident. And then, you know, you got to have patience out there. It's kind of a numbers game. You're not going to go on a stalk and kill every time. It's almost like you learn from blown stalks and you use what you learn for the next stalk. And that kind of leads in, you know, to being persistent. You know, you got to stay with it and you can't get upset over situations when they don't go your way. You know, as a bow hunter, you know, more times than not, it's not going to go your way. And
that's for sure.
It's just the way it is. So, but I agree with Dan. I think, you know, preparation would be the number one thing. Patience, you know, is a really probably number two, and then just being persistent would be like a number three for me.
Yeah. Patience is something I've yet to learn. I blew it, man. I blew it on a 105-inch coos buck last week or 2 weeks ago now. I rushed it. I started panicking that I wasn't going to get the shot, so I moved, and he caught me moving. And so when I drew back, he blew out of there. But had I just sat there and waited to let him do his thing, he wasn't going to leave the damn dough that was sitting there. And I just started freaking out that he was going to leave. I had him at 36 yards. I couldn't shoot him through a bush. And I was just kind of waiting for him to feed into a spot. And he started feeding away and stayed kind of behind that bush. And then he kind of popped out and gave me a little look at 57. So I started scooting over so I could get a shot. And but, yeah, I patience is something I'm always go, and I can't seem to talk myself out of it. So, but anyway, sorry. Go ahead, Dan. You were about to give me your second, too.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, another thing that's a critical factor as far as success is, you know, pre-scouting. I mean, you know, being in the right area where the animals are at, you know, increasing your odds is huge. You know, knowing the water sources, you know, where the animals are at, you know, because, you know, hunting the desert, we've been in areas before where, you know, I mean, you can glass and glass and glass, and there's just nothing happening. You know, especially, you know, if we get a dry year, you know, it seems like these deer tend to, you know, they're more in the green up area. If you can find an area that's green, you know, there's some water sources nearby, you know, it's a big bonus. So, you know, I think getting out there, you know, doing your pre-scouting, you know, eliminating areas that aren't holding deer, you know, I think that's just a huge factor as well.
Yeah. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's number two. What's your number three?
You know, pretty much, you know, what Dave said, persistence. I mean, more time in the field, you know, the better your odds are. I mean, you know, most guys I know that are, you know, pretty successful, you know, like Dave said, you know, a lot of times, you know, we just don't go out there and get on the first stalk and make it happen. It just doesn't happen like that. You know, the more time in the field, the more stalks you're on, you know, learning the deer, that's just, you know, that's huge.
Right.
You know, so persistence, you know, getting out there and just, you know, keeping after it, you know, it's the biggest thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't think anything trumps time in the field. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
the more tries that you give at it, you know, eventually something's going to come together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't spend much time this year, or this January anyway, in the field at all. I think I got to hunt for myself like 5 full days maybe. It was really shitty. I did like 6 half days and then, you know, 1 or 2 full days here or there, but it was just, yeah. And it paid. I didn't tag out this January.
That's a perfect example of time in the field, you know. Maybe if you'd had another, you know, couple more days, you could have sealed the deal.
Yeah, for sure. Was it me or did it seem like the rut was really weird this year?
You know, John, certain areas, it just seemed like the rut just wasn't, you know, wasn't happening on schedule like it normally has in the past. Having said that, we would jump across the road to a different unit, and it was completely different. The rut was on fire. It was just like night and day. So, you know, it just seemed like you had to be at the right place, right time, find a hot doe.
Yeah.
It was kind of a weird rut, it seemed like. And it actually seemed like it was just a little bit later than normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why that is, but it just seemed like it was pushed back just a little bit further than it normally does.
Yeah, I couldn't figure it out. It was just, I actually felt like I saw more deer in December than I saw in January. And I saw good bucks in January, don't get me wrong, but it was just, it just wasn't as crazy. Like, I didn't see quite the amount of chasing. And it wasn't like, usually by the second, third week of January, you can't glass up those that don't have at least one buck, even if it's a little shit buck with it, but a one buck trying to harass them, you know? And
mm-hmm.
I kept glassing up, you know, pretty big groups of does and still not seeing bucks at all. And it was just like, huh, you know? I never experienced that in you know, all the years I've been hunting out here, that it was that way.
Yeah.
And I didn't notice that with the coos, deer were fine. but it was the muleys themselves. Like, the Cuda, I mean, they started right before Christmas, and shit, they're still going now. I mean, they're still chasing hard when I was down there last week, and my buddies were just, I was talking to yesterday, they were on Coons Bucks chasing those yesterday. So, you know, it's just, I just felt like the mules were a little funky this year. I don't know if it was just the areas that I was hunting or what. But
go ahead, Dan.
You know, like Dave said, you know, some areas we went to were just nothing happening at all, and then, you know, hit a different area or different unit, and boom, I mean, the rut was happening. You know, we usually find the rut hitting the latter part of December into January here in Arizona. You know, I've harvested three deer, you know, on December 27th. You know, I usually find Christmas time and after, you know, the rut really kicks in, and, you know, January for sure is usually prime time rut. But yeah, it was a bit weird. It did seem like where we were hunting, the peak of the rut was the second week of January. Is what we found this year. But it did seem to taper off towards the end of January for us.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe it was just the weather patterns. The moon came at a weird time. You know, full moon came at a weird time. It was a little different. Anyhow, well, that being said, you're talking about areas. What are some of the things you look for in an area? What are some of the things that help you determine this is where I'm going to start my hunting efforts? Let's stick to deer, since that's what we're talking about. Obviously, it's going to be
for
elk or antelope.
John, one thing we do is we're constantly checking water sources. We're constantly looking for track and washes. You know, even as we're driving, you know, from one water hole to another, we're looking, you know, for the obvious, you know, tracks. Usually when you find, you know, a good number of tracks in an area and there's, you know, good feed, good water, a lot of green up areas, you're probably going to find deer in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, you know, we like to use trail cameras. We do use them on water sources quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I look at it, you know, kind of as a tool, you know, to kind of show you what's in the area.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you find something on there you like, you know, then you can start figuring out the area, you know, where the good glassing points are, you know, where you can glass from, stuff like that. And it's just a matter of spending some time out there in that area, and you'll start seeing, you know, the animals showing up.
Right. I stopped running trail cameras on water holes specifically because I kept getting them stolen. I feel like there's not very many secret water holes out there anymore. What do you guys do to keep your stuff from getting stolen? Just put it on there,
you know,
cops,
John,
on there, they know it's you guys and they're not going to take it from you, or what?
I wish.
I wish it was that easy.
Or that's probably the opposite. They're probably seeing your trail camera there. They'll probably set up three more and steal yours.
You know, I got to say, this last year, 2016, was the first time that we did not have a camera stolen. You know, we had out, you know, close to 20 cameras. And, you know, we never had a single camera stolen. So that was a first for us for sure.
Wow.
But, you know, we like to use bear boxes, and we lag them, you know, to a tree, and then we'll use a Python lock. And
yeah.
But, you know, if they want it bad enough, they're going to get it.
Oh, yeah. I had a Python lock on my bike in the back of my truck, and they suddenly stole my freaking bike this morning.
Oh, man.
Yeah, brand new
Facebook.
Yeah, brand new Rad Power Bike. It's one of those electric bikes, you know, it's power assist when you pedal. And I used it one day. I left it back there because I was going to drop my truck off at the dealership this morning. I was like, all right, just ride the bike back home, you know, so I'm waiting for a car or whatever. And then sometime between last night and this morning when I drove my truck to the dealership, it got stolen up. freaking pissed off.
Bummer.
Yeah, they cut through that python pretty easy, apparently.
Yeah, if they want it bad enough, they're going to get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, actually, I haven't ran cameras in like 2 years out here because I had a really bad year 2 years ago. I had like 4 cameras stolen. I was just so pissed off.
We've had our fair shares taken, that's for sure. Trust me. That's a gamble. That's the game. It's going to happen, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's pretty terrible. So we're talking a little bit about water holes. I get this question all the time, and I know what my answer to people is. I like to hear from you guys what you think. So especially like in the early season, you know, when you're planning on hunting water, you know, maybe sitting in a tank or whatever, it always seems to rain that week that opening week starts or something like that. And what's your take on sitting water when it's rained within the last 2 or 3 days and just like puddles everywhere? What's your take on hunting water that time of year?
Well, me personally, you know, I feel like if there's puddles that are standing, I think a deer, you know, in his natural feeding habitat, is out there feeding, comes across some puddles, you know, I think he's going to more likely drink out of the puddle. That's way more convenient for him, you know, than come to a water hole. I mean, you know, they say deer are creature of habits, which, you know, they probably are to a certain extent, but, you know, I just feel like, you know, when a mule deer comes into water, they're so cautious already as it is, you know, not just because of hunters, but, you know, that's a place where predators can, you know, predators know that the animals go to water. I just personally think that, for me, I think the odds are low for animals to hit water, especially when there's standing puddles out there. I probably wouldn't do it. You know, Dave may feel a little bit different on that subject.
No, I pretty much agree with what Dan's saying. You know, they are a creature of habits, and, you know, there's a chance that they could pop back into a water hole after 2 or 3 days, you know, after it's rained, but you know, they're going to take the easy route as well. If they can get to a puddle that's already in the area where they're bedding or feeding, they're going to do that for sure.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you can't sit water hole and kill one, because like I said, it can happen, but I think it would have to dry out. You know, the puddles would have to start drying out for them to start getting back into the water holes.
Okay. Yeah, see, I've gotten mixed reviews all the way around. You know, like I heard, like you said, people say they're a creature of habit. They're still going to go to the water. You know, and I've heard people say, you know, they'd much rather drink out of the water tank than a puddle, especially if it's like muddy, you know, really muddied up puddles. I don't know, you know, I've tried to look at it from a biologist standpoint of view a couple times, and you know, nothing really makes sense to me one way or the other, and I think it's a gamble one way or the other that they're going to come. I'll be curious. You know, I'm going to try to get Brian Rims on here too, because I know he likes to hunt coos deer in the water, over water in the early season. And I know he runs a lot of cameras and stuff, so he might have some technical data on that, you know. Oh, you guys run a lot of cameras. I mean, do you see when it rains, do you see that deer aren't showing up to the holes right after the rains, or, I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I was saying earlier, you know, I ran about 20 cameras last year, you know, because I had an elk tag, and I was more or less running them for elk, but a lot of deer in the same unit, and, yeah, I did notice that, John, you know, when the monsoons start coming through and they're hitting, you know, and it's raining really well, you know, not only the deer, elk, everything, you know, starts declining off the cameras for a little bit.
Okay.
You know, some of the lower units where it's hotter and it dries out faster, you know, they'll tend to come back, start using the water holes a little bit faster than some of the units
right.
up north. But yeah, that's definitely the pattern we've seen for sure.
We're gonna talk about that elk here in a minute after I get done with these questions, because I was an absolute stud of an elk, and I want to get a story on that one.
Okay.
What are some of the tactics you use during the rut here in Arizona? Now, I know that you guys are primarily spot stalk type hunters, so that part. What are some of the things you do in? You hear guys using calls. You hear guys, you know, rattling. You hear guys, you know, ambushing and stuff like that. What's your secret sauce?
Well, I would say the number one thing for us is we cover a lot of ground. What I mean by that is we're kind of a run and gun tactic in a way. We'll go to a spot, we'll start glassing, and if we're not picking something up within the first 15, 20 minutes, we are moving to the next spot, John.
Mm-hmm.
And that we've kind of always hunted that way. It works for us.
Right.
We've had other guys that have been with us, and they're like, wow, you guys glass an area quick and move. And we do, but, you know, it's effective, and it's worked for us, you know.
Yeah, I second that. I'm not quite as fast, maybe not 15 minutes, but, you know, if I'm not seeing something in about a half an hour, I'm out. I moved to another spot. And I picked that up from Dwayne Adams, you know, 15 years ago, and that tripped me out that, you know, we'd look at a spot, and if we didn't see something, we were gone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically said, if they're not there, they're not there. And I said, okay, sounds good, you know. And I guess that comes with you know, trusting your glassing ability. So, you know, back then I wasn't super confident with it being, you know, glassing. I was primarily a, you know, a stand hunter or, a, you know, not a, more of a still hunter than a spot and stalk hunter. And, you know, if I wasn't seeing something, it was just because I felt like I wasn't seeing them. Like they were hiding from me, you know? But yeah, if you're real confident, you're not picking up something right away, especially during the rut when they're moving around a bunch and, you know, it's colder, the deer are up on their feet, and it's definitely, I guess, advised to move to the next spot. So I agree with you on that one.
I mean, I'd like to add, you know, what Dave was saying, you know, I would say 75% of the time we're usually hunting from a side-by-side, you know, razor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll know where our number one spot is for the morning where we're going to start off. And, you know, we may be glassing off of the main road, you know, main dirt road. We're not necessarily way back in there a lot of times. You know, we'll start off in our number one spot, and like Dave said, we'll glass for 15 minutes. If we don't see anything, we'll go down the road a half mile, set up, glass, and we'll keep doing that all day. Now, we've had situations where, you know, we'll pick up a shooter buck with some does, you know, but the situation isn't right. And we've had it where we've left that buck, kept going looking for other bucks, maybe finding another buck in a better, you know, stalking situation, then circling back to the one that we left and see maybe, you know, an hour later if we feel like maybe it's in a better spot to stalk. So, you know, I'd say 75% of the time we're covering ground like that, mm-hmm. which works for us. Maybe 25% of the other time is, you know, when we have a buck in an area that we, you know, we want, we'll go to that specific area. We'll glass, you know, that morning. If we can't pick them up, then we'll stay in that area and get up higher on some different knobs until we pick them up. You know, we will, you know, if we find a buck we want, we will hunt that buck and stay in that spot.
Right.
But generally speaking, we, you know, we tell a lot of people, you know, cover as much ground as you can. The other thing I'd like to add is, you know, when we spot a buck,
you know, can't say it enough, having what we call the eye in the sky, which, you know, is a guy up on a higher knob glassing for you, you know, whether you're using radios or hand signals. I mean, that's pretty much what we do. You know, once we find a buck, one guy gets up high, the other guy moves in, and, you know, having that guy up high, seeing what's going on at all times is just huge for you.
Absolutely.
You know, can't say enough about that. But
and having somebody who knows how to do that is the biggest thing. There's not, you know, you know, if you haven't done it enough, you know, you can put anybody behind the glass and they're going to tell you, oh, yeah, go this way, go that way. But you got to think like the hunter is thinking down there and be able to see the terrain the right way, because it doesn't look the same. You know, it's always different when you get down there. And being able to judge yardages and stuff like that is, I think, is an art in itself. So.
Yeah, and another thing is, you know, we've glassed up a buck that, you know, we want to shoot, put a stock on him, you know, say he's got, you know, a handful of does with him, stock didn't work out, you know. We come back the next day or even the day after, and, you know, this, you know, especially during the rut, you know, we picked up that buck a day later by himself. You know, whether he's left that group of does looking for another group, when you can find a buck solo in the rut, that's usually money for us. I mean, that's what happened, you know, here this January with Dave's buck he killed. That was a buck that we had seen a week prior, you know, with, I think he had like 6 or 8 does with him. I don't remember for sure, but he had a handful of does with him. And then, you know, a week later we picked him up and he was solo. And, you know, that's a perfect situation. I got up high and Dave moved in and guided him right in and worked out perfect.
Nice.
So if you can catch those bucks, you know, because they'll cover some ground in the rut. You know, they'll go from, you know, they may be with does, but they'll leave those does and go look for other does.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, because there might have only been one doe that was ready in that group, and, you know, he had his business with her, and then he caught a whiff of something else 3 miles away. He'll go, you know, he'll go for it.
Yeah.
We've killed a few deer like that, you know, during the rut solo like that, you know, when the bucks leave does looking for other does.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you can find that situation, that's usually really good for you.
I had a buck that was with one doe. It's one of the bucks that I called Bruce Willis. This bastard's just, he's living up to his name. He is so, never sticks around long enough to even get close enough to shoot him. Anyway, he ran this doe probably a total of 6 miles. And he ended up about 3 miles away from my spotters. That's how far away I was from them when I finally gave up, because he just kept getting further and further away. You know, I didn't spook him. Hell, when I sat down, I started putting on my Sneak Tech boots. I was about 400 yards away, and they were bedded down. No chance in hell they could see me or smell me. The doe stood up to stretch, and his ass jumps up because he saw her get up, and he goes right up her ass, and he starts pushing her again. They were, he went like another 2 miles. It was just like, oh, man.
Yeah,
I mean, that's part of the fun of this time of year, but, well, hey, what's your favorite time of year? What's your guys' favorite time of year to hunt deer?
I'd have to say for me, it's definitely the rut. You know, being able to hunt close to home. You know, and our thing, John, is we're primarily mule deer hunters. You know, we've killed coos deer. But, you know, our passion is mule deer.
Right.
And so having said that, being able to hunt, you know, within 45 minutes of the house and chase mule deer that are rutting, I would have to say for me, it's definitely the rut hunt.
I agree with you. It's my favorite. It's my favorite time of year.
Having some, on top of having some nice weather, you know, you can't beat it hunting deer in the rut. I will say this, though, John. Hunting velvet bucks in August, I will say that the deer are very palatable at that time of year.
Right.
Especially when they're bachelored up. You know, if you can find a good buck in velvet, the chances are he's not leaving that area.
Right.
And, you know, velvet deer, like I said, are very, very palatable. They tend to do almost the same thing every day. You know, they'll feed the same area, bed the same area. You know, from my experience, they don't go far. But I would agree with Dave that the rut is definitely my favorite time. But
yeah.
Sometimes, you know, that August hunt can be really rewarding, too, being able to pattern those big bucks.
The velvet deer are my Achilles heel. I shot a lot of, like, little forkies and a couple of smaller, you know, 4 points and 3 points, but I've never killed a big velvet buck anywhere. It's crazy. Like, I had some opportunities in Wyoming and in Utah and whatever, but every time I end up killing a buck, it always ends up being hardhorn. Either he just rubbed off, or most of my bigger muleys are from here, are from the rut. But I've never, I don't know, I know it. One, I don't like dealing with the heat, so I feel like I don't spend as much time. And I know my other big problem is I can't glass into the sun. Something about my eyes, like, I can't do it. Like, I can do it for about 10 minutes, and then I'm screwed for the rest of the day. I won't be able to see. And I know that time of year, you know, to look into the shady slopes and look into the areas that they're going to be hanging out in, I can't look that way. That's probably my two biggest problems. So, but I don't know. One of these days I'll make it happen on a big velvet muley.
Yeah, you need to draw that strip tag.
Yeah, I'm getting enough points. I'm getting pretty close for that archery hunt. For sure. I could probably do it. I think I got 7 points. No, can't be that many. Maybe not.
You just need to put it. You need to put in with Dan. He's drawn it back to back years now.
Yeah, exactly.
he's got that luck going.
I'm pretty lucky with tags, though. I'm pretty lucky with tags. People are always accusing me of running some kind of racket where I'm like greasing the fish and game departments. But
yeah, we seem to have some pretty good luck here too lately for tags. That's for sure.
Yeah, and you guys got some pretty good ones. So, tell me about the elk, man. It was a unit 21, right?
Yeah, John. Last year, I drew unit 21. My son also drew the tag with me. So, you know, my goal was really to try to get him his first archery kill. He's really gotten into bow hunting and. So kind of went into the hunt, you know, trying to get him a bull. And then, you know, I thought it'd be my best odds of killing my best bull in that unit. Good friend, Brian Rims, I had the tag the year before. He killed a real nice bull. And, you know, in the past, there's been some really big bulls come out of the unit. So I guess I had high expectations going into it for my best bull and then trying to get my son a bull. And so I took the hunt, you know, probably spent more time scouting on that hunt than any other hunt I've ever done. You know, I ran close to 20 trail cameras, you know, trying to find a big bull and, you know, put about 2000 miles on my razor throughout the whole summertime.
Jeez.
Scouting. It would take me 3 full days. You know, to make the loop and check all cameras because, you know, that terrain in there is pretty gnarly and
Yeah,
the roads are
pretty
rough. Yeah. So spent a lot of time scouting. Finally had a bull show up on a camera that really caught our attention. Seemed to be ahead of every other bull horn growth wise, and definitely towered every other bull body size. I mean, he was a big bull.
Mm-hmm.
And he would end up he would show up on three different cameras throughout the summer, so he was kind of tough to pattern. But he kind of held in one general area, so we kind of knew the area he was in the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I believe it was Tuesday, 3 days, let's see, when was that? I want to say it was 3 days prior to opening day. I ended up locating the bull, and I sat on that bull from dark to dark until Friday morning of the opener, watching that bull, just watching his every moves. And, you know, for people that have hunted Unit 21, you know, that time of year, you know, we're still pushing 100-degree temperatures in that area.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not a traditional elk hunt by no means, but
it's
had a lot
high
of
desert.
Yeah,
it's a high desert.
It's a high desert elk hunt, and you know, a lot of rattlesnakes too on that hunt.
Yeah.
So you're constantly, you know, watching where you're walking and everything, but ended up having you know, a lot of friends come up and help me on the hunt. And was fortunate on day three to stalk into the bull and get a shot off and connect on him. And, you know, the bull ended up, Brian Renza ended up scoring it at 391, I believe it was.
Wow.
So definitely a giant bull and be a tough one to beat for sure.
You'll figure out a way to do it.
Well, if that happens, that would be good, but I'm pretty content with that bull.
You'll figure out a way to get a bigger one. I know it. So,
but
and then your son ended up getting one also.
Yeah, I was about ready to say. We ended up calling in a bull for him that he shot. I want to say it was the second to the last day of the season.
Yep.
We stayed really persistent with him. The good thing about 21 is we were able to, you know, he's able to go to school throughout the week, and by the time he came home, we were able to run up and hunt the evenings.
Right.
And he ended up killing a bull the second to last day. Made an excellent 60-yard shot. Bull took maybe 10 steps and fell over. Him killing his bull was more of a highlight than me killing my big bull, to be honest with you.
Oh yeah, I can see that.
You know,
that's awesome. I was there. It was the second to last day because I was there on the last day because I know Jake and Shane came up to help you guys pack that bull out, and then I met them the very next morning. They hadn't even gone to sleep yet, and trying to help Jake Dahmer's get his bull that last day because he had that same tag as you.
Yep, that's right. I want to say
because we were in your razor.
Yeah, I let Jake borrow the razor the last day.
Yeah.
And I want to say we got off the mountain at about 4:35 that morning with Shane's elk, and Jake and those guys went right into the hunt the next morning without any sleep.
Yep. Right. Yeah, we got in there, we got 50 yards on a bull and just didn't have a clear shot. Unfortunately, ended up throwing up a goose egg for that hunt, but that unit's tough. It can be really good, like you said, but it's also a really tough unit.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, it's not a traditional elk hunt by no means. I've had people ask me, and it's something that you definitely need to prepare for if you're going to put in for it. Matter of fact, I'm not even putting back in for it.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's more like a mule deer hunt.
It really is. You know, there's some big bulls there, but, you know, you're constantly looking out for rattlesnakes. I mean, it's 100-degree temperatures. It's definitely it was definitely an interesting hunt for sure.
Nice. Well, you guys got anything planned for this year so far yet? You know, you're just going to be playing the tag game here? Are you going other places or what?
Well, we always go to Utah and hunt archery deer there in August. We are going to put in for some tags in Nevada and Colorado and New Mexico this year.
Nice.
So hopefully we can get lucky with something.
Elk and deer or just deer?
Yeah, I think we're going to definitely do deer, Nevada, Colorado, elk for sure, New Mexico. And probably even go for sheep over in Nevada.
Yeah.
They say that's the best.
Yeah, best chance of getting. Well, they give the most tags for desert sheep out of any state. I don't really know if your odds yet are any better, but. I mean, I guess if there's more tags, then you get more odds. But I think everybody knows that, and your odds don't really get any better because there's that many people putting in for them. So,
exactly. You know.
Yeah. So, anyhow, but, well, that's cool, man. And, that's all I got for you, you know, as far as questions and stuff. I'd like to hear about the strip tags a little bit before I let you go.
Yeah,
because you guys both scored. What was it? Was a year before you both got you both got the tag, right? And then was it Dave or Dan who drew it the second time?
Yeah. So in 2015, Dave and I, and actually a buddy of ours, there's three of us who put in on the application. We went in with 8 bonus points. Still not really enough to guarantee you a tag by any means.
Right.
We were able to draw 13B archery, which was our first choice. Not knowing anything about the strip except for what you read or see, you know, all you see is big bucks most of the time.
We ended up calling our good buddy Chad Woodruff up and ended up doing a scouting package with him. And we went up for 1 weekend with Chad, and he basically took us to an area, and we had another guy draw, Josiah from Ross Outdoors. He was not on our application, but he drew, so he went up with us. So there was 4 of us with a tag.
Okay.
And when we met Chad up there, he basically took Dave and Josiah to one area. And he had told me and my buddy to go to this other area, you know, and told us where to set up in glass. And, man, me and my buddy went to this spot, and I've never seen so many bucks. I mean we sat in one spot that morning, and we must have seen, you know, 20, 25 bucks. It was amazing. And I actually saw the buck that I killed that morning. And, you know, thinking that we had found a gold mine, we meet up with Dave and Chad and Josiah later on, and you know, I'm telling him about everything we saw in the one buck, and Dave's like, "Oh, you should have seen the buck we saw. It happened to be the draw time buck."
Oh wow!
So here we all split up. We all find some really good bucks. We're all excited, and so anyways, when the hunt started, you know. That was a scouting package we did, so we were on our own from that point. That was pretty much our goal, was I was going to hunt the buck I saw, Dave was going to hunt the buck he saw. And, you know, you're hunting in August, the bucks are all bachelored up, they're all in velvet. So I was able to pretty much find this group of bucks. There was 12 bucks together, and after 2 days of watching them, figuring out what they were doing, I was able to pretty much pattern them. And what I ended up doing was they had two trails that fed from their feeding area over to their bedding area.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't necessarily use this. There was two trails, so it was kind of 50-50 gamble what trail they would use. But I ended up on the third morning, I built a blind about 50 yards off of the trail. And sure enough, here comes all those bucks, single file line. And they weren't very alert. They had their heads down. Just their goal was just to get to their bedding area. And ended up coming right down the trail in front of me at 50 yards.
Oh,
the hardest part was trying to figure out which buck. They were all
big bucks. Which one to see. That's a good problem to have, man.
Trying to figure out which one was the right one was a situation that I'd never been in before. And ended up shooting the right buck. Double long shot. He went about 50 yards. And, you know, walked over to him. And, man, I was just, you know, I have to admit, I had tears coming down my eyes. That was definitely a dream come true for sure.
Wow.
Brian Rims ended up gross scoring that buck at 217.
Thanks.
And then I let Dave tell his story.
Yeah, so like Dan was saying, you know, when we went up there scouting, he had found his target buck, and I had found the drop time buck with Chad, and I was pretty dead set on that drop time buck, regardless of score, John. Just having that big dropper like that.
Oh, yeah.
Something I risked. Yeah, I mean, I had to have that deer.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we had seen him scouting pretty close to a water hole that we thought he had been, you know, would be using. When we arrived 2 days before the hunt opened, we had checked the camera and he was not on that water hole at all.
Yeah.
And we actually hadn't seen the deer the first couple of days of the hunt. Nobody had laid eyes on him. And we had four other tag holders camped down the road from us. And they kept coming over asking us, you know, if they could sit some ground blinds we had set out. And we kept letting them sit that ground blind on that water hole, you know, where we had seen the drop time.
Right.
And they, you know, they would come back and say, oh, we missed a couple bucks, you know, we had some shots, we had some deer come in. Finally, on the, I want to say it was the fourth evening, I just decided that, you know, I'm going to go down there and sit that water hole this time. You know, I haven't seen the drop time buck at all, but didn't have a whole lot going on. So I said, I'm going to go ahead and sit it that evening. Got down there, got in the ground blind. Probably there for about an hour and a half. Deer started slowly starting to come in. And then I look over to my left, and the drop time buck with two other bucks were just coming at a, I mean, they were just coming right for the water, man. They didn't even hesitate. And I tell you what, you know, I stay pretty composed usually. I got to admit, when I seen that drop time coming in, I was pretty excited. I was shaking pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he ended up coming in the water. He put his head down. He was 45 yards. And I ended up making a really good shot on him. He was drinking water, and he had picked his head up to kind of walk out of the water hole. So he was, at that point, kind of quartering away, and that's when I took the shot.
Uh-huh.
Put the arrow, perfect placement. He ran maybe 30 yards and fell over.
Nice.
And
nice.
Kind of like what Dan said, walking up to that deer was pretty emotional for me. Regardless of what he scored, it was a buck I wanted. And you know, Brian Rims, I ended up gross scoring it at like 205 and 2/8, I believe. And so for both of us, that's kind of been a goal, you know, in our bow hunting, you know, as long as we've been bow hunting, we both wanted to kill a mule deer over 200 inches. Yeah.
Yep.
So to do it the same hunt, the same year for us was pretty awesome, man.
That's awesome. Well, I know if I draw that tag, I know who I'm giving a call. I'm calling the Acostas and your buddy. We're gonna go find me a 200 inch. I've been, it's just like everybody else who hunts that trophy hunts anyway. I don't really call myself a trophy hunter, but yeah, I want to join the 200 club myself really bad. I've had some close calls. I've missed a couple 200 inch bucks, unfortunately, but yeah, no, I definitely would love to. I'd love to get a big one, especially a velvet. That would be like the icing on the cake, knowing my history with velvet bucks. Sweet. The one you got this past year was a big son of a bitch too. What about?
No, actually, John. Actually, the last year on the strip, I was pretty picky. And what a fun hunt it was. I mean, you know, the year before I'd only hunted, you know, the third morning I'd killed. So I really took last year to the end. You know, I got to admit, I passed quite a few bucks within bow range that, you know, would score 185 to 195-ish.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, on the second morning, I was sitting the same trail. I had this buck. Two bucks come in. One was a 4x5, and I had them at about 185 and a 2-point, and they come right down the trail, but instead of coming fully down the trail, they turned off the trail and caught right in front of me at 18 yards. And
oh, wow.
They bedded there at 18 yards away for about 45 minutes. Never experienced anything like that in my life. It was awesome. I decided I didn't want to shoot that buck. It was the second morning. It was early in the hunt. There was two other bucks I was chasing, and passed a lot of good bucks, but the buck I ended up wanting to shoot, I ended up stalking the 30 yards of that buck, but, you know, that scrub oak was just so thick I couldn't see that deer, and he ended up jumping out of his bed, and he went out at about 60 yards, and I ended up making a bad shot on that deer, and we ended up trying to look. He was a 4x8. That deer wasn't about scoring for me. He was just, I loved his character on him.
Right.
And we ended up looking for that buck for like 3 days and just never, ever could seal the deal on that deer. Could not find him. But yeah,
I thought I had seen another picture floating around with you. Maybe I was, confusing it with the ones from the year before.
Well, I wish you would have seen it. Yeah, sometimes that's just the way it goes, you know. Not everyone's successful. And but no, it was if you can draw that tag, I think everybody should, you know, at least experience that hunt once for sure.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Well, I might have to start looking at that for sure. Well, boys, I want to thank you guys for coming on and, you know, sharing some of your wisdom and your stories with us. You know, I'm sure I'll have you guys on again eventually, maybe talk about some elk hunting or something. Yeah, it was cool, you know. End of the season now. You guys going to be doing any spring hunts or anything or just –
You know, our boys have a junior turkey hunt, I think, in April.
Okay.
So that'll be our next adventure, I guess. And then after that, it just, you know,
just wait till
see what tags. Yeah, see what happens with tags and season and go from there.
Cool. All right, man. Well, best of luck. Hope you guys draw some good tags. And I'm anxious to see what you guys pull out in 2017.
Thanks for having us, John.
All right.
Thanks, John. Have a good one.